All right, we're still on the lesson about how we communicate with husbands. And we're at the bottom of page 26, and so we're going to start our class and we're going to talk about sex. Boy. It's not a topic that we discuss often at church, and yet the Bible is replete with examples of how we are supposed to be in our sexual relationship with our husbands. We're to become one. We're not to withhold ourselves from one another. His body's ours, our body is his. So while our human nature kind of sometimes goes, oh, I don't want to talk about that, it's a part of God's word, and we don't have the right to ignore it. And if we do, then we are going to harm our marriage. So while I don't think it's a topic, it is a private topic. It's not something that you want to discuss what's going on in your marriage. But globally, it's a topic that we have to talk about and explore. And I think we won't spend a whole lot of time except to talk about the fact that we are to become one. It is a sexual relationship approved by God. The marriage bed is undefiled. It's not a relationship that's approved by God in any other form. But we have to acknowledge that men and women are different in their approach to the topic, and they have different needs and different feelings, and it's our job as wives to understand what our husbands need. Is it their job to understand what we need? Yes. We're not talking about them today. We're talking about us. That's right. We're just going to leave him alone. So, the topic of... There comes Joe. We're going to let her get here. The topic of sex is really still about communication. I had a friend one time. Well, husband of a friend, actually. I'm not sure I was his friend. But I was teaching a class called Human Intimacy at Tarleton. Now, as you can well imagine, the students took it thinking it was a sex class. It really wasn't. It was a communications class, because there are very varying ways to be intimate with people. And she was trying to explain this to her husband, and he said something about, well, you don't have sex with everybody. And she said, you can be intimate without having sex. And it no way he understood that. But you can be intimate without having sex, and you can have sex without being intimate. And the goal in the Bible is that we have that special intimate relationship with our husbands in all the ways that we're allowed to do that. Sometimes men do have more trouble understanding that the physical act and the mental process are to be melded. And so we have to, you know, the Bible tells husbands to live with their wives with understanding. And while it doesn't say that specifically in those words to women, we're told in a whole lot of ways that that's what we have to do. We have to understand our husbands and how they approach things and what they want and desire, because a lot of times men have trouble expressing that in words. So we have to become detectives and figure things out. And we have to be willing to talk to our husbands about these intimate things. Difficult sometimes, because our nature may be that we don't want to do it, and theirs often is that they don't want to talk about it. And you can get into a stalemate that becomes unpleasant and tense. So I don't want to spend a whole lot of time on this, but I do think that it's a topic that we need to consider. We need to understand that it's an important aspect of marriage. And if we're going to become one person, then we have to understand each other and work to fulfill the other's needs and desires. I did like her comment about respecting our husband in all things, and that includes in a physical relationship. He may be the person that really, truly does not want physical contact in public. Maybe it embarrasses him, makes him uncomfortable. And we're the kind of women who hold hands all the time. Maybe that's not what we need to do if that makes him uncomfortable. Or maybe we could screw up our courage and say, I really like that. Could we do that? And maybe he'll be able to say, well, yeah, I could some. But the idea is that we've got to find out who that man is, and we've got to work within what he wants and needs, as well as trying to be able to express what we want and need. I also liked her comment where she says, if you'd like to read an excellent book on the marriage relationship, I'd recommend the Bible. Now, I teach these topics. This is what I do. I teach marriage and family, parenting, communication, growth and development, human intimacy, all those kinds of topics. And I guarantee you, in all these 30 years I've been teaching it, there's not a better textbook. And I've read lots of them. There's not a better one out there than this one. And interestingly enough, quite a few of the textbooks refer back to biblical principles. I mean, actually really say that Christianity, I mean, they're not going to go so far as to say, look at this verse, but, you know, they'll use a biblical reference. So, unless y'all have burning questions and things we want to talk about on that topic, we're going to move on, because I understand, you know, it doesn't bother me. I'll talk about any of it, but there are people that it makes me uncomfortable. Yes, ma'am.
One of the elders' wives in Florida had commented before that when wives beg off on this, they're hurting themselves.
Sure.
And she wasn't just talking about hurting themselves in the physical loss, but the emotional connection that you have with your husband, the more you deprive him, the more he closes himself off from you.
Right.
And so it's a very serious thing.
It is. And the Bible addresses that. We're not to refuse one another unless by agreement for a season for prayer and fasting. It's not okay to say no on a continuing basis. You married somebody. You made an agreement, even in public, that this is the kind of life you were going to live together. It is not okay. Now, does that mean that you're a slave to his desires? No. Because if he's living with you with understanding the way he's supposed to, there are going to be times that it doesn't work. But you're right. Every time you say no for selfish reasons, it harms the relationship, just like anything else. If every time you ask him to do something for you, he said no, you quit asking. Does it mean you quit being annoyed about it? It probably means your resentment grows. I don't know if I should use that example or not. Maybe I won't. But when you have asked someone to do something and they continuously refuse, you come around to thinking, A, they don't care about what I need. B, they're just doing that to make me mad, which is sometimes true. And C, I'm going to quit asking, but I'm not going to quit caring. Which leads us right back into that double stamps on Wednesday thing that she was talking about. Most of us in this room, not Erica, not Caroline, but most, not Bonnie, can remember trading stamps. S&H green stamps. And they were double stamps on Wednesday. We used to go to ladies' Bible class when I was a little girl. I'd go with Mother, and then we would go shopping at Safeway because it was double stamp day. I remember it very well. And you put all the stamps in a book, and when the book was full, you got to take them to the redemption center and get stuff. That was the best day, because they just had all this stuff. Walmart didn't exist. You girls have to understand it was a completely different world. You could not buy everything in one store, but you could at the green stamp store. They had decorations, and they had toasters, and they had just all kinds of stuff if you had
mixers.
Mixers. Mother had a Sunbeam that lasted for 45 years or so from green stamps.
So the way our, I guess it was Julia, the way we gave her Christmas presents.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the idea of saving them up and then getting something is fine. Unless you're doing it like they're talking about here. Well, let's see. I fixed him dinner 3 nights in a row, and I didn't say anything when he didn't wash my car like he said he was going to. And so I'm getting points for this. I'm getting points. And when I get ready to bring him in, buddy, he better watch out. We used to call it the your mother wears army boots fight. The fight that where it doesn't have anything to do with what you're fighting about. You just pull out everything you can think of and throw it in the fight. So it'll escalate really quickly and burn with a much hotter fire. Bad, bad, bad choice. If you must disagree about something and try to come to some conclusion, you really have to keep it on that topic. You really do. So, you know, you can't pull out the your mother wears army boots thing to throw into that fire that doesn't have anything to do with your mother. It has to do with something y'all said or did.
I hope some of this stuff you're teaching you didn't learn at home.
Yeah, well. Nobody fought at my house growing up, I will tell you that. It was a very, very quiet, harmonious, for the most part, house. But if anybody got in trouble, the quieter it got at my house, the more trouble you were in. She'd make you sit on the stool and talk to you. That was bad. But the wisdom.
I have a stool. It worked.
It worked real well. But unfortunately, I did learn to fight. I learned to fight in that first marriage. And it's taken a long time to unlearn some really, really bad habits that I got into, because I didn't learn that growing up. I didn't learn fighting or yelling or any of those things. But that's how Randy grew up, and I did learn it. And I'm really, really sorry that was ever part of my life. I'm sorry that my children experienced any of that.
Did you fight or did you defend yourself?
Well, maybe a little of both. I'd like to say it was all his fault, but I learned to fight. And yes, I did have to defend myself, and I did it in yelling and screaming, and that's a terrible, terrible thing. And I wish it had never been part of my life. But I've worked very hard to unlearn those bad habits, and I think I'm mostly there. So this pulling out the double stamps, I earned this. He's made me mad. Now he's done something that's triggered it. I have a right to be mad. Do we ever really have the right to be mad? Not angry in the definition, the Webster's definition of the word angry. But mad, out of control. You know, the real term for mad is somebody who's insane. And when we're that kind of angry, do we ever have the right to be that kind of angry? Did Christ ever exhibit that kind of anger?
In the temple.
Not insane. He knew exactly what he was doing. He was angry. And that's the point I'm trying to make, that there is a difference between being angry, and sometimes we have the right to be angry, but being mad, in that we don't pay attention to what we're saying, we don't pay attention to our actions, we lose control. And as a Christian, we can't lose control. Debbie?
And that usually happens when you hang on to something and you don't express those feelings
right
at the time it's happening.
Right.
And I know I've done that before. You just, you know, what's wrong? Oh, nothing. You know,
nothing.
For whatever reason. I didn't want to get into it then. Or thinking, okay, this will go away, and it doesn't. You know, and it just builds. It harbors. And like you said, it comes back later, mm-hmm. several weeks, when something else comes up.
And if
that's not fair,
it's
not
fair
fighting.
It's not fair. And if we could pull ourselves out of the situation and listen to ourselves, and this other person, be it our husband or our child or a friend, who's going, what? What are you talking about? Because they don't even remember what you're mad about. Amy?
In Helen Andelin's book, Fascinating Womanhood, I don't know if anybody here has read it, but it was one of my staple books when I was a new bride. But there's a chapter in there about how to get mad at your husband in a way that allows him to save face, mm-hmm. and still be in love with you, mm-hmm. even though you're angry. And, you know, it talks about childlikeness, mm-hmm. rather than childishness.
Oh, yeah.
Childlikeness. You know, when a little girl stamps her foot and pouts, we think it's cute. Well, our husbands do too. And it talked about that, you know, it's okay to get angry. And he doesn't want you cowering in the corner or, you know, clamming up and refusing to tell him what's wrong. He wants to know what he did to you. He wants to know so he can fix it. It's, you know, you can, you know, slam the door and say, I'm never talking to you again. That still endears him to, because it's an extreme. And he knows it's not true.
Oh, whereas, I have to completely agree, disagree with that one. But
the point is, I can tell you, when I used to tell my husband, you're just being a mean old nasty bear, and I'd walk off, he'd laugh, you know, but he'd fix it. It would soften him, you know. And that's the kind of stuff she talks about, that it's okay to get angry, it's okay to express it, but do it in a way that allows him to kind of chuckle a little bit and save face.
And I can see that point. My personality would never allow that. I would go throw up just from saying it. So that would never work for me.
Yeah.
But I understand what she's saying. To try to get a little humor into the situation.
The scripture, "Be angry and sin not," used to drive me crazy. Still does. If I'm going to be angry, I'm probably going to do something I shouldn't do.
And that's where we have to work on the
whole
thing.
That's where we have to work on.
Yeah. But I do think it's important that we express anger, if we need to, in a way that doesn't... You don't want to take a machete after somebody. You know, you don't want to leave them with wounds that can't heal. And that's very easy to do. What, you know, all those things about our tongue that we looked at earlier? That's very easy to wound someone, and we need to think about what's going to be left over if I say this. What's going to fester in their minds? And no matter how many times you come back with something sweet, that wound is still there. And it may heal over, but wounds leave a scar. And enough of those over time, and your relationship is damaged, maybe irreparably. So it's very, very important that we handle our anger with a soft approach. And like you said, if we can inject humor into the situation, then that might be a good way to handle it. But we can't just say whatever we want to say because they'll feel better. Too bad. Sometimes you don't get to feel better. If that's what it takes to make you feel better, sometimes you don't get to.
And if you get to say what you want, why doesn't he?
That's right.
And usually you don't want it better anyway.
Right.
I've made that mistake of saying what I thought would make me feel better, mm-hmm. and I feel worse.
Mm-hmm. Because you know that you've inflicted real pain on somebody else. And if you love someone, you don't want to inflict real pain on them. You might want them to pay attention, do something differently, but you don't want to inflict real pain. So the other night I said something to Roger about, don't be mad. I don't know what I had done, but I said, don't be mad. He said, I have never been mad at you. And I looked at him, he said, I've been annoyed. But I've never been mad. He said, there's a difference. Because I knew it wasn't quite true that he had never been mad at me. Okay. We've talked about the soft word, turneth away wrath, never letting the sun go down on your wrath. I read some book the other day. I can't remember what it was. She said, everybody says don't go to bed angry, and that's not true. Sometimes you just need to sleep it off. Mm. If you're annoyed, that probably is good advice. You know, something little happened and it's made you irritated. Go to bed, and you'll forget about it when you wake up. But if there's true anger there and something has really happened, putting it off is not the best solution, in my opinion. The Lord said, don't let the sun go down in your wrath. He knew that the longer you leave something unresolved, the harder it is to come back and fix it. So I think there's a real difference between irritation and anger. Wrath.
Wrath is defined in Strong's as violent anger.
Yes.
It's that anger that would let you actually physically hit him.
Yeah.
Maybe you wouldn't, but you
but
want to.
But it's there.
But it's there. You want to.
And as many things as you all know that I've said about Randy over the years, that never happened. And I saw one time he was so angry, I actually saw his stand like this, and I saw his knuckles get white. And I thought, I may have crossed the line there. I back off on that. But to control that kind of anger, and I think it becomes easier with age. You know, we've had enough battles that we, with not maybe within the marriage, but any place else, that we've learned to control and we've learned what works and what doesn't. So I do think it's more of a problem for most people as they're younger. Now, that's not to say that we can't all have moments that we don't handle very well. And there are some people that don't learn. And they're just as quick-tempered in their old age as they were younger.
And some are proud of that.
Some are proud of that. And I've had people say, well, I just have a quick temper. I don't care.
Fix that.
That is not an unchangeable character trait. Mm-hmm. It may be your tendency, but you don't have to do it. It may be your tendency that you want to steal emeralds every time you see an emerald, but you don't have to actually do it. You know, that's the thing that I have a hard time understanding when people say, well, that's just how I am. No.
But God made woman for man.
Right.
He needed someone with him. We have to be a person that he can have with him.
Right.
Helps him.
That he can stand to be around?
Yeah.
That's what you're saying. Yeah.
We're going through counseling with Eric, and he has been given forms to fill out, and we have been given forms to fill out, and they're difficult to answer.
Yeah.
And one of them was, as a younger person, how did you handle your anger? And now that you're older, what have you done to correct or improve that? Slamming doors is still a good thing for me.
I can never make them quite loud enough for people to go, what was that?
I can. I shake the foundation. But I know I'm mad, but I really tried to tamper that down. Mm-hmm. And this has been a very hard questionnaire to fill out. I'm still not finished at all.
One of the things about having my grandchildren with me is I do see an improvement. I do see a more calm attitude. And then I feel guilty about my kids, mm-hmm. you know, and wish I could go back and mm-hmm. handle that in a different way.
But you can't be 50 when you're 25.
I know.
No.
But it would have been nice.
Well, yeah, hindsight.
Because, you know, the boys are making all this noise and dropping things, and I'm going, don't do that. And we'll keep. But with my own kids, it was very different, and I feel bad about that. I really do. That, Mother, brings us into the who's helping whom on page 28. We do have to remind ourselves, maybe particularly in the world in which we live, that God made woman for man, not the other way around. And this whole thing about all the shows on television about the divas and the brides and the, as if the whole world revolves around you as a female. And people want to excuse it. They want to go, oh, she's just a diva. No. That's not what it says. And I think particularly those bride shows, which I can watch for about a minute and a half before I just want to punch my hand through the TV screen and I turn it off. But I have actually seen one woman on that show that I watched longer than 3 minutes say to her future mother-in-law, I'm marrying him, he's mine, you're out.
Ooh.
And this man was going to marry her. What's wrong with him? You don't lose your family when you get married. You add to your family. You get more people. Mm-hmm. And to say to the woman who reared the man that you love, you're out. I can't believe he went through with the marriage. Erica.
I'm kind of like reading this book right now. It's like a prep relationship book or something. And it was talking about that and how that's one of the mother's like biggest fears is like when losing their sons to a woman.
Absolutely.
And like basically how like you have to be so careful on letting the mother still have her chance to love her son and have son time with him even when you're around to be able to have that bond. And I guess that's what makes like being younger and stuff, that's what makes me look at it in a love when I see family-like relationships where you're not just going in by yourself on the day
right.
all the time, you're going over doing houses.
Right. Because your parent-child relationship does not end just because your child marries. And
I think you can't have too many people who love you and care for it. And
you
too many people that you love and care for.
That's right.
Just makes your life better.
If you isolate yourself and cut off all those other people, you're losing. Mm-hmm. Not only is your husband losing, you're losing. I have the little boys. I get them on Tuesday and they spend the night with us, and Roger's got them at Lowe's right now. But normally,
she's punishing him. Right?
Because we didn't want him here with us. Normally, Randy picks them up for breakfast and either brings them back to me or brings them to Fort Worth or whatever. Now, that's not an easy thing for me to do. Call Randy and say, do you want to come get these boys? Because my personal belief and desire would be that he doesn't see anybody that I like. You know, he'd just be gone. But the truth of the matter is, he's their grandfather, and more people to love them is a better thing. Y'all going to have to help me work with that one, because it's not.
That's right.
It's not my tendency.
I see where you're going. I understand.
But for their sake, it's a good thing to have another person in their life who loves them. So to isolate ourselves from family who love us and care for us and can help us when we need it, not just physically, but emotionally. But I figured out a long time ago the way to keep my son close to me was to have the best relationship I could possibly have with my daughter-in-law. Because if he has to choose, if I put him in a position of choosing, who should he choose?
His wife.
His wife. And that's how I brought him up. So I can't create the problem. Now, I can't control everybody else's behavior, but I can control mine. should.
In 1 Peter, it tells you, likewise, you younger people, submit yourselves to your other. Yes, all of you, be submissive to one another. Mm-hmm. And be clothed with humility. For God resists the proud and gives grace to the humble. We really need to understand that that verse applies in our marriage just like it applies between all the rest of us.
It absolutely does.
And when we do that, then who's helping whom is kind of a...
Well, but again, that's his job. And we're not talking about his job today.
It's both our jobs.
But we are commanded to be insensitive to our husbands.
We are. There is a specific place for us. But he is to consider, as we've been saying.
Absolutely. And I do think anyone who is a Christian, who spends their life trying to follow what God says, is going to have far fewer marital problems than anybody else. Far fewer. In fact, I'm not sure how you hold a marriage together if you don't have God. Because when that time comes, as it does for almost everyone, I haven't met anybody yet that it didn't, but you know, maybe they're out there, where you kind of wake up and go, what have I done? I wanted to marry him. What was I thinking? And you have your biblical underpinning. Okay, well, I might feel that way this moment, but I married him because I loved him. We have a home created by God, and God says we're going to stay in it. So I better get my act together and fix whatever's going on. Okay, get out your tools, it says. A wise woman buildeth her house. Is that possible? Can we create our home the way we want it to be?
Yes.
Sure we can.
When mama ain't happy, ain't nobody happy.
That's exactly right.
I knocked the wall down the other day.
Which wall, David? Which wall?
Between the living room and breakfast room.
I don't think you meant literally.
But it's a nice metaphor.
It sure is.
You felt better, didn't you?
You knocked a very fine wall down.
After the first piece of sheetrock, it's just work.
But the first time the sledgehammer hits, it feels
all right. Good. Once I'm tried in, though, I couldn't have done it without it.
But we are capable of building our home. We are the keepers at home. We are the ones that set the tone. Like you said, if mama ain't happy, ain't nobody happy. On the other hand, if mama is happy, peace and harmony can really be easily created in the home. That can be more challenging as children are at specific ages where their development is, I'm going to push. And that's not true at every age, so it comes in spurts. But if we can maintain the calm and the peace that God can give us, then we can get through those troubling times that are troubling for the children as well. Sometimes we forget that. Sometimes we think that the children are creating these problems because they like to create the problems. And the truth is they're struggling as they're trying to get to that next level. And if we can remember that, it can be helpful. Somebody was going to tell me something.
When
love is in the home.
It's harmony.
Yeah.
I really like that song.
Yep, and it's true.
Mm-hmm.
This talks about what we've just been talking about. A successful marriage depends more on the attitudes than the partners. Now, it's saying the high failure rate of second marriages bears out the fact. I'm a little more research-oriented than that to jump to those conclusions. But the fact is true that a person can get along comfortably and well and love many people. That whole thing about you're my soulmate, you know, you're the only person in the world for me. Really? Billions of people in the world and there's one that you can find? That's not true. It's not true. I'm fairly convinced, not totally, that two Christians who are completely committed to living a godly life could marry and be happy. They might not be madly in love. But I think they could live a happy, harmonious life if they both said, we're going to do what God says. And arranged marriages actually tend to work out very well throughout the world. But they have a society that supports that as well. So it is about attitude more than partners. Even if the partners turn out to be wrong, a good attitude could solve it, could fix it. Now, do I think that you should deliberately put yourself in a relationship where it's going to be a struggle to be happy all the time? No, not if you can avoid that situation. But I'm just saying, if you find yourself in a situation where it doesn't seem happy all the time, maybe you need to look inward and see what you can do to make it be a better situation.
One thing that's huge, and as women, I think we forget this. You know, we want our husbands to notice that we scrub the floors and that the windows are shining and we hung new curtains. But we don't always take the time, and I made this mistake as a young wife, to thank him for getting up early in the morning when it's hard, when it's still dark out, and going to work every single day, doing the same thing every single day. A little appreciation for that goes a long way. When I finally got it and started thanking my husband for that, he would do anything for me.
Yeah.
It was amazing the difference that appreciation meant to him.
And that's true for everybody. That is human nature. We want to be appreciated. And you were talking about wanting him to notice the windows shined up. I physically take Roger by the hand and say, see what I did? Tell me it's good. Because I need to hear that. But as you said, thank you for taking the trash out every Tuesday and Friday that I never think about until I hear the trash truck and it's too late. You know? All those things that they do in our lives are to be appreciated, because I'm telling you, as Amy can tell you and several other in this room, once you've done it all by yourself for a while, you start thinking, oh, wait, I could have been more appreciative of that. Erica?
I like the part about the attitude, because I find that that's a lot of it, because a lot of people will just quit relationships because it's like, oh, well, I don't feel this anymore. But it's like, if you look at someone and you love them once or whatever their stupid reason is, you can find something in them that you're just like, I love that about them. I mean, it can be as little as something, but if you focus on the positive
things to appreciate.
Like,
that's right.
My sister was here summer, and she had a hard time this summer, and I kept telling her, I was like, you know, if you just found things you liked, you would love it here.
Yeah.
I was like, that's how I moved on, like, that from the initial move. I thought I was going to hate it, too. I came here, and I just got a job, loved my job, and got me there.
You find the things that make you happy, and then some of the other things don't look as bad anymore.
You don't dwell on the past or what you don't have right now.
Right. Carolyn?
Just kind of going back to that, it's the attitude, not the partner. I had a really funny quote, and I want you married women to tell me whether or not it's true. This writer, it was quoted by a preacher in a sermon. He said, you know, you think that there's only one person out there for you, but in fact, you've only known this guy for a couple of years. You become engaged, and you marry him, and you're marrying a perfect stranger. And so there's this writer who said, in the past 30 years, my wife has been married to 5 different men, and each one of them has been me.
That's right. That's absolutely right.
Yeah.
Because we all change just that much.
And it's true of him, too.
It is. He's been married to 5 different women.
He drives him nuts.
You can miss certain things, too, once they're no longer with you. I know when my shoes needed to be shined, I stepped in mud or something right after my husband died, and he was a stickler. He kept my shoes. When I kicked them off after church, he picked them up behind me and went and cleaned them and polished them. And when he wasn't there to shine my shoes for me, I think I missed that. Of course, not more than I missed him.
No, but it was a sample of the things he had done showing his love for you. Yeah.
Without asking.
But I got mad at him because he wasn't there to be with me.
Yeah, well, yeah. I agree. That's part of it. Yeah. Amy?
You'll also find when that person isn't there anymore, those things that irritated you the most about them are the things you miss the most. It is weird. My late husband had a weird sense of humor and told the dumbest jokes ever. I mean, so stupid, I would roll my eyes and go, oh, brother. But after he died, I missed that. That was something silly and quirky about him that just...
Mom, I think you have that back.
You gained it.
Thanks, Erica.
But yeah, we do turn into different people as we go through life. And if we're cautious, we turn into better people. If we're not, we could slide into, you know, I get very concerned because I've heard many people say that old age is what pushes forward your character traits. And it worries me that some that I've hidden so carefully from all of you will just pop through as I get older.
Well, here I am. That's what emerged.
It's concerning to me. But if we are cautious and continue growing as we go along, we will be better people, which is, of course, what the Bible intended for us, that we learn and we grow and we work at being better than we were. Anyone who's not better at 50 than they were at 20, some serious problems going on. Mm-hmm. They failed in doing what God wanted them to do.
That is absolutely true. I know I was joshing about the other, but there's truth to that. You're growing all the time, right, and you better be growing for the better.
That's right. And that is probably one of the things that's the most frustrating to those of us who are older, trying to talk to so many, not all, of the younger people who are not able to understand that yet. You're old, you don't know what you're talking about. No, I'm old, I know a lot more about what I'm talking about than I did at your age. So, but I don't think that's a new thing. I think that's, even though in generations past, children were taught more to respect their elders and listen, I think Christian children still are, but I'm talking about the world at large. I'm not sure they always did it uncomplainingly. Maybe they were just quiet. Because adolescence tends to believe that they have the answers. That's part of growing up. You have to get that confidence to be able to move into adulthood. If you still felt like your parents had to take care of you and you never got into the, I can do this by myself, then how are you going to be an adult? So it's an important transition stage. It's just one that those of us who are older find irritating at times. And the kids do too. Let's flip on over to some of these discussion questions because we really need to be finished with this lesson this week. What are some nonverbal ways that a husband can show his love and concern that we might overlook? Well, your husband shines your shoes. Mm-hmm. Amy?
My late husband used to buy something that I needed or wanted, but he wouldn't make a pompous display of, here it is, I bought this for you. He'd go set it up wherever it was that it needed to be used. Mm-hmm. And after he died, I was looking for something in his pickup truck. And one of the things that was sitting on the seat in his truck was a set of driveway lamps that we had said we wanted to put out front. And he had bought it intending to put it in for me. And I didn't know until after he had died. And it was just, you know, that was his way.
Listening and doing things that you've said. Maybe they don't go, what a great idea, I'll do that. But they heard it. What are some other ways?
Mark is always doing stuff. He never stops. He'll fix the girls' cars. He'll fix something that's broken, or, you know, he never stops.
Yeah. Kate hit a deer last night. And fortunately, a buck. But fortunately, she was in her truck, and it didn't hurt the truck too much, but it bent, and she couldn't drive because it bent the fender up against the tire. We were about to go have ice cream with some friends, and Roger got in the car and went out to Easter to get her truck fixed. Now, that's not his kid. He loves my children, but that's not his kid. And he got up.
She called her dad.
She did. She called Roger first. And I said, why don't you see if your dad can help you, because we're about to go. And he didn't answer. So she called Roger. So that's showing his love for me. He cares about my kids. But that was showing his love for me, that he would do that for my child. Older women should teach the younger to love their husbands. Now, I've always joked about that and said, see, it's learned behavior. If you don't love them right away, you have to learn how to do it. Probably shouldn't say that. But what are some of the things that as older women we can tell the younger women to help them love their husbands? We don't have much time, so.
To accept those things that he does when he's trying to make amends.
He may you know, not bring you roses.
And my own daughter said to me, I need to hear those words. I know you do, baby. I understand. I need them myself. But he's really working hard at making amends, and you must accept that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What are some other things we can tell him? That the day that you're perfect, you get to expect perfection from him?
Mm-hmm. That's what I was going to say.
Mm-hmm.
appreciate him the same way you want him to appreciate you. Right. Expect or give to him what it is you expect of him.
And like Erica said, look for the good. You married him for a reason. Focus on those reasons. And yes, there are going to be some things that irritate you, and there are plenty that irritate him. I mean, we're people. That's just how it works. Don't you have friends that you care a lot about, and yet there's those one or two things they do that you just wish they quit? It doesn't mean you don't love them and care about them. You just wish they quit that.
And don't have unrealistic expectations. When I was a new bride, I hated to make the bed. And when I wasn't married, I used to wiggle from the pillow all the way down into the bed so that the sheets stayed tucked, and I wiggled back out in the morning, and I just tightened it up through the cover.
And you expected him to do that?
I was so mad because at night he'd take the covers and whip them from one end to the other. It took me about 2 weeks of being married before I realized, Amy, he's 6'3". He's a big guy. There's no way he can do what you do.
Well, I have very limited experience with men and their bed covers. I would venture to say that 99% of them are not going to wiggle down into the sheets.
It was an ugly
anybody, is that right? To say that?
Do you hear what we just said? That the golden rule applies here like it does everywhere else. Treat others the way you want to be treated.
Right.
It applies.
Okay, we've got just a few minutes. I want to talk about a couple of these. Discuss nagging and its various disguises.
Aww.
I want to hear that.
Yeah, me too, Mother.
She's taking everything away from me.
I think the disguises part is really important because a lot of times we do nag. We pretend it's not nagging. We'll do it in such a way that
We remind.
We encourage. And none of that's wrong as long as it's done cautiously. But when it becomes, you didn't do what I want, and I'm going to keep saying this till you do what I want, that, in my mind, is what creates nagging. Now, if what you're reminding them of is, okay, you said you were going to go get the registration sticker for the car, and it's now due, I'm not sure that's nagging. I think that might be reminding. But if it's, you said we could have a new car, and we don't have one, I want a new car. When are we getting a new car? I want my new car to be red. You know, all these things that are just, they're to suit us, and we keep poking at them. That, to me, is the definition of nagging. Now, you can tell me if I'm wrong, but I do think you have to remind them sometimes of the car registration's never going to happen. Of course, I'd just do it myself and then say, put this on the windshield. That is his job, to put it on the windshield. What are some other ways nagging can be disguised? I'm thinking of one that I know y'all never use. Erica, you're smiling like you know.
Well, I can use one from work, but, like, I have to ask for food constantly. And, like, I don't want to just be like, give me my food like everyone else does. So I try to work around it and be like, is it possible that we have a medium fry back there? And you know, like, I'm kind of like,
could that be mine? Well, I think one of the most nefarious ways that women nag is by using their children. Remind your dad that he said blah blah blah, or go ask your father if we're going to. Now, there are times when it's legitimate to send a child, you're in the kitchen, you're busy, go ask your dad something. But there are times that it's used so that you can look like you're not nagging. That's unfair. It's unfair to your husband, who's in a position of having to deal amicably with his child while he's really annoyed with you. It's unfair to the child, who's an unwilling participant, unknowing participant. And I do think women use their children that way. And it's not fair. Now, don't get me wrong. It's okay to say, go call your dad to dinner. I can't holler loud enough to get him. Not saying don't ever use your children as runners. That's why God gave us children. But don't use them in a way.
Legs.
That's right. That's young right. Legs.
That little legs.
Who like to run.
How can we reinforce our husband's position as head of the family? I think that's an easy one to answer. We act like it. We act like we know it. We treat him in such a way that he knows that we know he's the head of the family.
Go and ask your dad works really well with this one.
Yeah. Yes. That's an excellent time to go ask your dad.
That's a good place to go ask your dad.
Yeah. I remember being little. Now, I do think it was my mother just trying to get me out of the house. I do. But Daddy got home at 4:30. And I get home from school, and she'd say, "Now, this first part, I think, was really a very good thing. I remember it well, and it made an impression even at the time. We need to get the house straightened up. Your dad will be home soon." Mm-hmm. Because the house had to be straight when Daddy got there. But then as soon as we got finished, she'd say, "He'll be home soon. Go wait for him outside." An hour.
So you wouldn't miss that.
She didn't want you to miss that.
That's right. That's right. 1 Timothy 5:14 instructs us to guide the house. Does this conflict with the instructions that the husband's the head of the household? No, why not?
In the same way Joseph was head of Potiphar's house.
Right.
Exactly. We are stewards.
It's given. It's Keith Rowland one time told me that he saw it as being, he was chairman of the board and Vicki was the college president. She got to fix things and do whatever she wanted until he saw something that didn't work. Mm-hmm. He said, "But I don't want to concern myself with that every day. I got stuff to do. I want her to do that." But it's given to us. The authority is given to us, but the authority, the true authority, still lies with him.
Well, that's back to being equal but separate partners. Yeah.
We have different jobs.
Mark appreciates my caring for the things in the home because he can't be there.
Right.
And, you know, he doesn't have the time to do all that he does and run the house.
Right.
Last year would help me.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And if your husband says, "I want you to do this, this, and this, but I do not want you to feel like you're in charge of this area," then do we get to say, "But I want to"? Does that mean you can't talk about it and discuss the issue and hope that he'll change his mind? But if he doesn't change his mind, he doesn't. It goes back to what we've talked about in every lesson so far. Choose well. Choose well. All right, we're past time. Thank you for all the comments, and we will begin chapter 4, finally, next time.